Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. What do we mean by walkability? What makes a neighbourhood walkable, and why does it matter? These are questions I put to Tim Farrow, a transport researcher who's been championing mobility on foot for more than 40 years. We agreed to meet and walk through the streets between Waterloo and London Bridge railway stations, part of London where Tim once lived, and where we hoped we would find some quieter places to record our conversation. Bankside, The Cut, and Waterloo Quarter, as this part of London in 2015 is now known, is a hive of construction and a tourist attraction to boot. We found few places of quiet, with Red Cross Gardens a welcome exception. Tim was also incredibly gracious and patient, as it was one of those rare occasions when I inadvertently failed to record the conversation, and I had to ask him if we could do it all over again. The recording opens with Tim telling us about his chief concern of traffic speed and how to calm it.
The relationship between people on foot and the traffic around them, that is key to walkability. I mean, obviously, a quiet street such as we're in now, it has a 20-mile-an-hour limit on it, very little volume of traffic. It's extremely walkable in that sense. But obviously, we have to consider arrangements whereby motor traffic is a fact of life, and how do we interact with that? The critical thing for me, at least as a short and medium term intervention, is to make sure that speeds are no higher than 20 miles an hour. At 20 miles an hour, it's no great problem for a driver to just dab the brake to allow pedestrian time to cross the street. At 30 miles an hour, he sees that as an intrusion on his freedom.
Imagine we are now walking in a more walkable city or a more walkable neighbourhood. What things would we notice that would be significantly different from what they are today?
Well, we would certainly have ways to walk which don't involve having to negotiate traffic equipment and things that are designed purely for the accommodation of motor vehicles. So when we cross the street, it should be possible for us to do that without having to change level, without having to deviate from our desire line, and to do it without being in fear for one's life or limb. One is very aware of this when accompanying, for example, grandchildren. Going for a walk with a two-year-old in London is quite stressful, because you know that they have no conception of speed. In fact, a child can't judge the speed of a vehicle until they reach the age of about 7 or 8. So a simple mistake by a young child can mean the death penalty. And so for people accompanying young children, it's very stressful walking around knowing that there is always that potential for major injury or being killed. So calming the vehicles and getting drivers, not just by force, but getting drivers to understand that they're in charge of a lethal weapon is an important change of culture that I would expect to see in the scenario that you paint of a walkable city. But having said that, places like central and inner London, relatively speaking, are very walkable because the rewards for walking are extremely high. And the bigger concern, perhaps, is the suburban and, more worse than suburban, the sort of non-places that exist, which have been designed entirely around the motor vehicle and accessed by car and van. These are the places which, you know, whatever speed the traffic's going at, they're not going to be walkable because they're boring places. They're even non-places. So those are the big challenges. I'd like to see a lot of that car-based development ripped up. Maybe not in my lifetime, but I would expect in future to see an end to out-of-town retail parks and business parks. They only call them parks because they've got car parks, of course.
Our cities make walking inconvenient, almost.
Well, Manual for Streets, I was one of the co-authors of Manual for Streets, broke new ground, perhaps, by saying that the first consideration in urban design, traffic design, street design, the first consideration should be walking or pedestrians. And so that doesn't mean to say that everything has to be for walking and no other thing is planned. It just means that when you start with a blank piece of paper, you start off by considering how people are going to move around on foot. And what would that mean? Well, one of the things that it would mean, for example, is an end to distributor roads. We have this bizarre sort of way of developing urban extensions, for example, whereby you get a housing estate, which in itself might be quite nicely designed, but it's plugged into the road network with a large roundabout and a distributor road. It's not really walkable, except within the estate, maybe. But trying to get anywhere else will involve inconvenient and unattractive walking environments. So that's the sort of thing that giving first consideration should mean. A roundabout, inevitably, not so much the mini roundabouts, but the sort of roundabouts that are planned for trunk roads, which are imported into the urban context inappropriately, when you're walking, they inevitably divert you from your path. They are therefore not designed for pedestrians, they're designed for vehicles. So, an end to roundabouts in urban areas.
There's a need for more housing in Britain. So, to accommodate that, the suggestion that Urbed came up with and were successful in winning the Wolfson's Economic Prize was about developing extensions to 40 of our existing towns and cities. And your name was in amongst the people involved in that.
Well, my concern was particularly focused on how to make those urban extensions walkable and also possible to be served by public transport. We must not forget that if we're promoting public transport, we can't do that unless we promote walkability at the same time. About a third of all trips made on foot are to access public transport. Another third is just to walk all the way, and another third is for, in very rough terms, about a third for pure enjoyment and walking the dog and such. But when we're presented with an opportunity to develop large new urban areas, we can so easily make them impossible to serve by walking and public transport. And Milton Keynes is an example of where the planners and designers simply didn't get it. So now it has a structure which is virtually impossible to make walkable and suitable for bus routes. And my concern there was to ensure that the designs being promoted by Urbed were suitable for being served in that way.
But you've been doing this for a very long time. Yeah, you told me that you were inspired by working with others in the as long ago as the mid-60s.
I was working as a researcher at the Planning Research Unit in Edinburgh University. I was privileged to work with some very interesting people, and one of them who came to share my office was Dr. Maya Hillman, who, of course, whose track record on promoting pedestrians is widely known. And he was an inspiration for me because he got me to see aspects of urban design which were crucial for making cities livable. Livable and walkable are really two sides of the same coin. For example, it was Mayer who said, when you want to cross the street, why should it be the pedestrian who has to change level? Why shouldn't the vehicle change level? The vehicle has rubber tyres and it's no great problem. Whereas curbs for pedestrians are something of a barrier. Well, in 1965 that was pretty radical stuff. And yet now we see it as best practice and it's being implemented throughout the London area and other cities too.
When you were at Edinburgh, that you were living in an inner city area, that the way you got to communicate and meet with people was by walking and dropping in on them, the sort of conviviality of dropping in.
Yes, I was lucky enough to live in the Royal Mile in Edinburgh, which is about as urban as you can get. And we lived without a telephone, me and my brother, in a flat there. And all of our friends lived within walking distance. It was quite a way of life to not have a telephone and yet still to be able to socialise and so on. Word of mouth was the means of communication and sharing places for social exchange and so on. So that gave me a strong sense of what it was to live in an urban area. And I suppose it struck me very strongly because I had grown up in a low-density suburb in a nice semi-D, in a nice street, in a nice corner of Kent. And, well, I grew up realising it was pretty boring. And when I got to Edinburgh, I thought, this is what a real city is like. And so that's really where I got my inspiration.
Obviously, walking is a benefit to all sorts of different aspects of life, not just sort of conviviality and getting around and affordability, but also one's health. And yet, it's kind of dismissed in the pecking order within local authorities. The officer responsible for walking is probably the lowest of the low. But also, at the same time, we don't seem to have it. Walking's never spotted as a solution to very much. It's HS2 or new guided busway or something like that that grabs the attention.
Yes, the great benefits of walking as a great asset, is its downfall in the sense that it is easy to do, it's even easy to plan for. So people tend to say, well, why do we need a strategy to learn how to put one foot in front of the other? Or they refer to the Ministry of Silly Walks or other negative things because it's seen as silly. Unfortunately, that means that there isn't the political interest. Politicians are driven by what they perceive being popular ideas. There's no media interest or very little, and the public at large tends to accept the situation and maybe is unaware of the possibilities. And there's no industry behind it, apart from the shoe industry, which is a very small part of the industrial scene. So yes, high-speed trains and motorways and car parks and so on and so forth, these are things which politicians can snip the tape on opening day and photo opportunities and such, whereas with a few limited exceptions like showcase pedestrianisation of Trafalgar Square or something, by and large what walkability requires is lots of very small interventions of a common sense and practical nature, and they simply don't command the attention of those who are driven by money, fame and ego.
Now, you were saying that may be changing in North America.
There is, there has been a movement for the past 20, 30 years, sometimes called the New Urbanism, sometimes referring to what they call transit-oriented development and walkable neighbourhoods. It's interesting that in America this movement has really been most prominent because it's in America that they've lost walkability in their race to become motorised. They didn't at the same time see that this would mean the destruction of walkable places. And so there they've lost the asset of walking. Here in Britain and on continental Europe, we have a high proportion of trips being made on foot, but we're losing that asset. We're not protecting it. We don't see it as an asset. So, for example, we devote endless resources and effort to promoting cycling, but meanwhile we're not putting that same effort into protecting what we already have. Cycling is only 2% of trips. Walking is more than a quarter and closer to a third in many places, and yet we're happy to see that decline without any great concern, and that does seem to me a completely wrong set of priorities.
Department for Transport, which I always think ought to be a Department for Mobility, but that's another matter. The latest consultation on the cycling strategy is...
Well, that's a very good case in
delivery
point.
For cycling is meant to include walking, but isn't in the title.
Exactly. That's exactly right. It's I suspect walking has just been added on, so some junior in the office has been asked to add the word walking throughout the document wherever the word cycling appears. And of course they're two completely different modes, they have two completely separate requirements, and in many respects they are modes which are in conflict with one another, or at the very least are in competition with each other. So a target to increase cycling, for example, one might question that if all that is achieved is that people walk less. If it adds to the total of active travel, that's very good. But the planning of it has to be done in such a way that you don't simply transfer people off their feet onto the pedals, which I can't really see as of much overall benefit.
What do you see are the sort of key things we can actually make a difference with, and the ones that we really need to push?
Well, on one hand, I'm quite gratified that a lot of progress has been made. The first pedestrian planning document I wrote, which was with Terence Bentnickson, just over 40 years ago, and the problems that were experienced then for pedestrians were much greater, I think, than they are today. So we should acknowledge that, you know, a lot of the changes that have occurred in city streets and so on have been very positive. And traffic calming, it was not really known when I started out, whereas now it's something which many people want to have in their residential streets and so on. It's widely known. The guidance document which I wrote for Devon County Council 23 years ago is still widely used, and all of the arguments and so on are still as valid now as they were then.
When you say it's the Devon guidance, it's actually used by people all over the country.
All over the world, actually. Yeah, I was in Portugal just the other day where people were saying, oh, I remember you did the Devon County Council guide. Well, it seems funny that it's Devon County Council rather than a national document, but they pointed out to me that they were actually the largest highway authority in the country. They've actually got the largest mileage of roads, even than the Highways Agency. So it's not altogether surprising that it's Devon.
It's Devon. But you're saying that traffic calming now, the term is out of vogue, but reducing speeds of vehicles, changing the balance between the pedestrian and the car driver is changing?
I think that is accepted, certainly in the residential areas, and we now have boroughs in London adopting 20 miles an hour as the default speed limit, changing it down from 30. Other boroughs are looking at it, other towns outside, and even New York has recently switched to 25 miles an hour as the default limit. So the speed thing is accepted. Traffic calming and the early shared spaces were very much focused on the need to change the balance of priority in local residential streets. What has changed in more recent years is the realization that this can be adopted as a technique on important streets, on busy roads and junctions. And there are some very busy places which have been converted to so-called shared space, which really means taking away a lot of the regulations and traffic signals and curbs and so on, which demarcate traffic roles, instead to get people to consider the street in front of them in a sort of common sense way. Nobody deliberately wants to run over and kill somebody, and so it's really a question of trusting each other. And if you take away all the paraphernalia of traffic management, then people are forced to use their common sense and to look about them and to see what's going on and to give way and be courteous and polite. As soon as you start making rules, then people get angry that certain people don't follow the rules, and it just generates that conflict. And an example would be where you've got a space which is shared between pedestrians and cyclists. As soon as you paint a white line saying cyclists on the left, pedestrians on the right, you immediately create conflict. The cyclist will then be very unforgiving of anybody who strays into that demarcated space. Whereas without the white line, it's perfectly natural to just give way and be courteous. So shared space has been around a long time, but what's more interesting perhaps now is the fact that it can be applied much more widely than was originally thought And Hans Mondeman, who I met in the Netherlands, who was the sort of so-called father of shared space, he said to me, I don't think there's any upper limit of traffic in terms of where this solution can be applied. In the town where he lived, he removed all of the traffic signals in the town. The last set was still there in place when I visited, but that's gone now as well.
Also, when we were walking, we crossed Blackfriars Bridge Road, and we had to wait for the green man. I was quite crafty. I managed to time it, so we got to the curb just as someone else had pressed the button. But when we crossed, we didn't actually have very much time to cross, and we ended up in the middle of the road on a sort of very narrow median strip, or whatever you want to call it, an island. And then we had to wait our turn again. We actually crossed on a red man because there was no traffic, but there were a couple holding hands who were very diligently obeying the signal. It seemed a very crazy, to me it was just something we just accept as normal, because we're pedestrians who have to put up with this stuff, but
I don't
surely know, that really needs to change.
A staggered crossing arrangement whereby you have to apply for permission twice in order to cross a single road, and also have to walk in between the distance in between the two parts of the crossing in the middle of the road. It's a clear example of something which has been designed for the convenience of the traffic capacity. So it's a traffic engineer device to protect traffic capacity whilst giving pedestrians some opportunity to cross the road. So it's a completely different thing from a walkable or pedestrian priority environment. Even the timing, when you apply for permission to cross by pressing the button and it says wait, it won't go green for you until it suits the arrangement of the traffic signals upstream and downstream on that road. So you're allowed to cross where it won't interfere with the capacity of the junction, which could be 200-300 metres away.
Which of course is something that we as a pedestrian, the lay person, doesn't know about. There you've revealed something that even I wasn't necessarily aware of, because I noticed how we got to another light, we pressed the button and it instantly changed, so you don't have any kind of consistency here. You some lights you have to wait for ages, and others they change instantly.
The crossings which are liable to have an impact on the total capacity of the road will be linked in to the timing of the junction signals as well. But where it's not critical, then it may be only a sort of maximum frequency of going green, so to speak, and will be triggered more or less straight away, which is not so bad. But again, the ability to provide pedestrian priority is influenced by the presence of the signals. So if, for example, you design the street with a raised part of the carriageway so you can cross on the level, when it's laid out in a different material perhaps, it's got different lighting and so on, if the speed is not too high, drivers will give way to pedestrians to allow them to cross. But if there is a signal, there's no way they will give way unless it's actually a red light for them. And there's a case in Whitney in Oxfordshire where in the same high street there are both arrangements. There is a signal crossing and also a crossing of the type that I described. And very noticeable that drivers will stop where there isn't a light, but they, if there is a light, then they'll only stop if it's red for them.
I heard someone say to me the other day something which I thought was quite telling, was that they said that as darkness descends, the city's connectivity fragments. And we've not really touched on that yet, but of the places where local authorities plan for pedestrians and recommend where pedestrians go, lighting and ground floor activity must be
important considerations. I think part of the problem is that we don't have any comprehensive way of tackling the planning for walking, so we don't have good data even on that sort of activity. We know about the number of trips that people make on foot, although even the data for that is pretty unreliable very often. But we don't know how much time people spend sojourning, so to speak, lingering in public realm. We don't know much about how they react to light and shade, to the climate, to changing seasons. I mean, London is very different today from very often with lots of children around because it's half term. So it's quite a different atmosphere, and also visitors from outside London who don't know where they're going, and so the atmosphere changes. But all of that is part of the richness of walkability, and we have very little understanding. Well, we know it intuitively, but we don't really have good data about it.
Can you recommend a couple of places that people should have a look at, go walk in and discover what it could be like?
I think perhaps because I once lived there, Waterloo, the Waterloo area where we've been walking this morning is a great delight, because it's such a mixture of environments. And there is some very good streetscape as well. Walking along the Cut, for example, is a much more pleasant experience now than it was before they did the repaving works. The South Bank Walk, I mean the Riverside Walk, a lot of effort has gone into extending that through the city. So that's always a delight, any weather, any time of day. But it's, of course, true that there are circumstances where after dark it becomes more of a hazard, especially if you're on your own, you're not quite sure whether you're safe or not. And so your mental map of the walking opportunities changes from city to city and from daylight to darkness.
Another example of where you like walking, perhaps yourself, where you enjoy walking?
Broadway, New York. Since they've created a lot of space for pedestrians, instead of being a traffic nightmare, it's actually one of the most exciting places on the planet, I think. Quite remarkable that the seating areas are provided at public expense. You're not expected to buy a coffee at Starbucks in order to have the privilege of sitting in the centre of New York, and that's something we could learn from. We think of America as being a privatised, everything costing money, but in fact their notion of public space has been transformed in New York, and that's something to really admire and learn from. Another aspect which is interesting lesson from New York is they did all this very quickly. The mayor realized the opportunity, and within a few short years this transformation took place. We tend to perhaps agonize too much about making changes and wait until we've got 25 million in our pocket to be able to do a showcase scheme like Exhibition Road, which, you know, it's nice to walk in Exhibition Road, but did it need to cost that much? Could we have done 10 Exhibition Roads with the same money? Would that have been better? So I think there's a lot of issues like that which could be addressed.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Tim Farrow. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited. Our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.